We're not here to endorse, enforce, change your course. We're not doctors, lawyers, or professional counselors or therapists. Please call those folks directly. This show is meant to get us all comfortable with thinking about our deaths, with thinking about a plan for our loved ones after we've departed, and an idea of what we believe. In doing so, we're forced to look upon our lives. When we do this, we leave with a little more thankfulness, a little more love for ourselves, our lives, our loved ones, and what we've accomplished so far in this short period on Earth. Aloha and good morning. How are you doing, Susan?
Okay. And how are you doing?
I'm doing good. We woke up on a side of the bed today.
Yep.
Which was good. Today's show, we were talking about just doing our favorite clips and songs and some things like that that we've compiled over the time of doing this show that we may not have had room for on other shows. So it's just a mishmash of things, if you will. And I guess I think what we're going to start with is Alex Honnold, who's a favorite of Susan's. And he's a climber.
He's a solo climber with free solo climber
with no ropes.
Yeah. And he died.
He died. Ironically, he died climbing with a rope.
Really? I didn't know that.
He did.
Oh my God.
Which is nuts, right?
Yeah.
I mean, climbing with a rope has got a lot of difficulty because you got the rope in the way.
And plus it might have given him a little sense of safety, so he might have not been as rigid if he had nothing.
Right? Well, I think that what's interesting about what we're postulating here is exactly what the clip was about that you sent me. Oh. So let's go ahead and give it a listen. Here we go.
I read somewhere that you'll actually visualize falling to your death.
Well, I mean, I have thought about it for sure.
Like what? Why?
Because it'd be worse to have never thought about that and then suddenly be in the position and be like, holy shit, you know? Like, it's better to think through like every different side of something. I mean, the thing is, like, if the idea of falling to my death is like insurmountable, like if I can't get past that fear, then like I probably shouldn't be up there. You know, you can't just like suppress that and then just like, I mean, you have to accept like the whole experience.
Yeah, and what will you see when you visualize falling to your death?
Well, I mean, you'd bounce off that ledge 20 meters below, you'd probably bounce off the ledge 40 meters below that, eventually you would just fall to the ground and you'd be like dead.
And you'll literally,
I mean,
see yourself doing that?
I mean, is that weird? Do you not do that?
Well, I'm not a pro climber either, so no.
But like, I mean, haven't you ever, like, when you're driving, haven't you ever thought about what it'd be like to just like veer into one of those little divide things on a highway and just like have your car explode or something?
Surely you've thought about it. Yeah, I mean,
Or like if you're on a single lane freeway going super fast, not with as much detail as. I think it's important to actually think it all the way through, because the thing is, there are a lot of places with big wall. I mean, people always think that with soloing big walls, like if you fall, you die. And I mean, that is true on the bulk of the wall, but there are a lot of places where if you fell off, you'd probably land on the ledge right below you, or you could probably, if you were thinking about it, you could probably grab something, or like, you know, if you're in a chimney system and you slip, I mean, you can basically self-arrest inside the chimney, which I've done before, but not soloing with a rope on. You know, so I mean, I think it's important to like think all that stuff through. You know, like one of the big solos that I did was Half Dome. And like technically the hardest moves on the route are like on the fourth pitch, like say 400 feet off the ground is like the hardest physical sequence. And it's above this big ledge thing that's kind of like a picnic table, or maybe like two picnic tables almost. So I mean, if you fell off the hardest moves, you would almost for sure land on the ledge and stick it. So I mean, it actually takes a lot of the commitment out, where it's like, if you fall off the hardest part, you're not gonna die, probably. Though, I mean, there's quite a bit of other hard climbing on the route. But you know, I mean, I think it's important to know that kind of stuff.
So free soloing and, you know, climbing with or without a rope is pretty much the same physically, you've said.
Yeah.
But mentally, explain why free soloing so much more challenging.
Well, it's kind of obvious, right? Because if you fall off, you're going to die. So it's like, obviously, there's a lot more like fear involved, and like there's more second guessing, or there's just more going on in your head.
Yeah, but you said for the most part, fear is kind of out of it for you at this point.
But so, getting the fear out of it is all like,
I mean,
stuff
I guess for me, I'd be scared.
Yeah, but like overcoming that fear is something that you go through beforehand, like before soloing, hopefully, you know, you like visualize, you deal with all those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know. You just got to go try it.
You know? It's not happening today. Why is it important to avoid getting your adrenaline going?
Well, I mean, it's important to avoid any kind of major fear response type thing, just because, I mean, you have like physiological changes, you know, your vision narrows, your breathing accelerates, like you over grip. Like, I mean, it happens a lot of time when you're climbing with a rope, you'll be like super, super scared and you like can't see anything and you're holding on super tight and you're like, oh my God. And then you get a piece of gear in and you like clip your rope and all of a sudden you're safe. And then you're like, oh, and you relax. And then you're like, oh, there's this other huge hold right here that I should have grabbed but didn't see. And then you're like, oh, and there's a foothold. And suddenly you're like way more relaxed. And so, I mean, you want to stay in that relaxed state the whole time.
But I think I've read before, too, that you said it's not even good to just get pumped for a climb.
You mean like amped up?
Yeah, like amped up.
Yeah, again, because I feel like that's a bit of a crutch if you just like, I mean, that's something that that a lot of people have done on smaller routes. Like if you're soloing something that's only like 30 or 40 meters, say like 100, 150 feet high, you can get like all super psyched up and then climb it and it'll take you like 4 or 5 minutes. So you can kind of maintain that like artificial high of like, I'm so psyched, here we go.
Yeah.
You know, but like if you're climbing like a 2000 foot wall, you can't just be like, here we go. You know, cause like 5 minutes later, you're like, oh my God, I'm really scared now. Or I'm like tired or whatever. It's like, you know, you can't just like artificially amp yourself up. You have to like have a nice even, you know, like controlled.
For more clips from this interview, visit grahambensinger.com.
What a cool guy, huh?
He was out there.
Yeah, he's the real deal, huh?
Well, he's confronting fear face on all the time, you know.
And not being afraid.
And not being afraid. I saw a documentary with him, and his mom was on the documentary talking about him. And
yeah.
How she couldn't get him off of anything, like climbing off up the couch and all that kind of stuff when he was little, you know.
Yeah, I saw that documentary. I don't remember what it was called, but it was really good.
I think it was just called Free Solo.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
It was really quite good. And they went out and they were climbing this ice mountain, but like some days the weather wasn't conducive, so they were kind of, remember, they couldn't figure out when to go out. But the thing I liked about this clip was when he talks about the physiological changes,
mm-hmm,
from fear.
Yeah.
You know, and that's
interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I mean, and everybody goes through it.
Yeah, so that's why you have to stay calm when you're climbing the face of a mountain.
Or you're driving to Lihue.
Right. That's why I don't do it anymore.
You're too busy visualizing your death on the way.
Right. Yeah, it is one of my big ones.
Well, I've got a Carlin clip.
Oh, good. He is so funny.
I hope he doesn't curse too much, so.
Or offend anyone.
He's going to offend everyone.
He means well.
All right. Enjoy.
Yes, you are. You're all going to die. I mean to remind you of it, but it is on your schedule. Yes. Probably won't happen when you want. Usually comes along when you're not expecting. Generally, you have your stamp collection out, you know.
Now?
No. Just want a little time to put away your hinges, you know. No. There's a time to die, and it's okay, you know. It's really okay. Nobody wants to die. Nobody. Well, you know, most people don't want to die. Nobody wants to die. Boy, if you think being sick is no fun, dying is really a pain in the ass. Nobody wants to die. People don't mind being dead. Being dead is great. But getting dead, nobody wants to get dead. So I hope I don't die. I wonder how often we think that, you know? It's just under the surface, isn't it? You go out for the day, going out of your house. I hope I don't die. It really spoil the circus. If I were to die, geez, I hope I don't die. Comedians don't want to die. It's only a metaphor, but it's so true of all of us. We don't want to die out there. A comic's going to die. I don't want to die. Jeez, I was dying out there. I was dying. It was death out there. And it was like a morgue. Oh, I don't want to die. Of course, if the comedian doesn't die, you know, if he succeeds, if he makes you laugh, then he can say, I killed him. I killed him. So it's either me or you, you know. Just like on the freeway. Yeah, dying shouldn't be that bad. It shouldn't be that bad. We're all going to do it. It's one of the few fair things in life. Everybody catches it once. And dying should be fun. There should be some sort of a look ahead. I mean, after all, when you die, you're going to find out where you go. Haven't we been wondering about that a long time? Where the hell we go? Isn't that the biggest thing we have to wonder about? Where the hell do you go? I don't know. Joe thinks he knows. I know Joe thinks he knows, but Joe don't know. Where do we go? Nobody knows. Well, I think sometimes you go where you think you're going to go. Whatever you think you're going to do, that's where you're probably going to go. If you keep saying you're going to go somewhere, chances are you might go there. You ever hear those guys say, I'm going to hell, don't pray for me. Don't pray for me, I'm going to hell. He is. You go where you want to go. I think when you die, your soul goes to a garage in Buffalo. When Monty Hall dies, he'll go behind door number 4. That's it, where you want to go. No, nobody wants to die. And you know, part of the reason we don't want to die is because of that funeral. We've seen it. We know how bad news it is. That funeral is no fun. Man, if I don't like other people's funerals, I know I'm not going to like my own. There's no way I can get behind my own funeral. I'm going to be lying there in a casket. They're going to put me in the box. Going to put me in a convertible with a top down. You know that's embarrassing, lying there. And everybody's looking at you. You're dead. And they're looking. You're just lying there still. People coming over going. They don't know that you're lying there with short pants on and no back in your jacket. Embarrassed. And sometimes they'll come over, you know, some people, it depends on your religion and so forth, but they do come right over to the casket a lot of times and they'll go like this. And they're silent for a moment. And what they're doing while they're silent is they're subtracting their age from your age. So they get a rough estimate on what they have left. And they get up and they say, don't he look good? Don't he look good? You crazy? He's dead. I know, but he never looked that good. Well, they say the nicest things about you. They say the nicest things when you die. Your popularity goes straight up when you die. They say the greatest things there are that can be said. They'll even make stuff up if they have to. Well, he was a real asshole, but he meant well, you know? He's a well-meaning asshole. Yes, you get so popular when you die. All the flowers you get. Think of the flowers you get when you die. You get more flowers when you die than you got in your whole life. All your flowers arrive at once, too late. The guys will say, oh yeah, well you know Bill is dead. Yeah, poor Bill. Poor Bill is dead, yeah. Poor Dave? Yeah, poor Dave is gone now. Ed? Yeah, poor Ed is gone. Dan? Thacker is still alive, isn't he? I wish he would die so I could like him.
We're back after our George Carlin clip. He said, where do you want to go when you die? What do you want to happen to you? I don't want everyone looking at me. I think I'm going direct cremation myself.
I told you that I've just read, because I've been reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead and that Pema Chodron book, that one of the things that they say is you need someone there to tell you you died. You need someone there to say, "You died, Susie. It's okay. Keep going. Yeah, you died. You died."
Oh my gosh!
I know. It's. I think I told you I want you to come and keep reminding me. Okay, you did.
You died, by the way.
Yeah, I guess there's, according to the Tibetan Buddhists, there's some sort of a place where you might not know. And a lot, like in India, they carry you out in one direction and they turn you around so you know you're not going home again.
Right, they face you away from home.
Yeah, so I guess there must be some conscious dissonance. What is that word?
Right, dissonance, yeah.
Yeah, about, well, what happened? Did I died?
I didn't die.
Did I die? And then you have your friend there saying, "Yeah, Susie, you died." Keep going.
Well, I think in Tibetan Buddhism, I think they believe it takes 3 to 5 days for your soul to kind of depart from your body.
And there's 49 days till something else. They have all of these kind of markers,
yeah.
Yeah, like it takes, like you're not, if you can, don't even touch the body for so many days.
Right.
And then there's so many other days that you're supposed to do something.
You know, that it's probably all in line. I mean, it's part of their grieving process.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Part of the process, I mean, they have this very far out thing that they believe about what actually happens, which takes you to your next life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, like every religion, I guess, has its protocol.
Right.
That's how it works. But the Tibetans are pretty far out, because when you consider it's like from centuries and centuries ago, and it's been passed down. And I guess just like Christ,
yeah.
You know, how things can get passed down for centuries and people still believe it, even though we have no idea what the truth is.
The ancient stuff is ancient.
And it's still around.
It's mysteries.
And we still believe it.
Yeah, you still glean from
I'm
it.
I'm still fascinated by, again, about the Tibetan Buddhists.
I find them really fascinating. Yeah.
Well, it's so complex and specific.
Mm-hmm. And the stuff that's kind of marketed towards us is not the ancient stuff. It's this,
well,
like,
it's translated,
newer one. Yeah.
And the thing I'm getting now in rereading it from when I was involved in it kind of in the 80s is how the Tibetan part is so focused on having it be for everyone. It's like it's so much more expansive than just you.
Yeah.
That it's about sending things out to the whole world and all suffering and
the
all
entire
dying.
Universe.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, that's pretty lofty.
It is.
It's where we all need to be, so to speak.
It is. And my favorite part of that whole part was in the suffrage, they want you to take in the suffering for all of humanity. You know?
And
take
send
in
out
the pain and then send out the love.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, speaking of sending out the love, I've got a rendition of Florence and the Machine, "You've Got the Love." That is...
This is all Jenna's young folk music.
That we're going to introduce Susan to?
I would play... my whole playlist is still the 60s, but...
I sneak some new ones. I sneak some newbies in every once in a while.
And she never tells me till she surprises me on the show, but...
That's okay. She's ready for the break.
It's good for us, for us old minds.
Enjoy. This one is actually a classical version, and she's playing at a fundraiser for cancer for children in this actual song. So enjoy.
One thing for anyone to realize is that you and all you... Every person you see will soon be dead. So it sounds so gloomy to us, because we have devised a culture fundamentally resisting death. I love the story of a conversation at an English country house at a dinner party, where the hostess started up the question of death and asked the various guests what they thought was going to happen to them when they die. And some thought about reincarnation, and others thought about various kinds of different planes of being, and others thought they were going to be annihilated. But all none of the guests had answered except Sir Roderick, who was a kind of a military type, but a very devout pillar of the Church of England. He was the church warden, chief of the vestry in the local country parish. And the lady said, Sir Roderick, you haven't said a word. What do you think is going to happen to you when you die? Oh, he said, I am perfectly certain that I shall go to heaven and enjoy everlasting bliss, but I wish you wouldn't indulge in such a depressing conversation. That's true, isn't it? Death in the Western world is a real problem. We hush it up. We pretend it hasn't happened. Our morticians, who are very smart commercial operators, know exactly what's expected of them. And they make death just awful by pretending it doesn't happen. See what happens. You go to a hospital and you're at the end. You've got terminal cancer. And all your friends come around and they wear false smiles and they say, cheer up, you'll be all right. In a few days from now, you'll be back home and we'll go out for a picnic again. The doctors have their bedside manner. You see, a doctor is absolutely helpless with a terminal case because he's a doctor's, by social definition, a healer. And he's not allowed to help you die. He's out of role. Even though, I mean, he may sneak behind the rules and do it, but he's definitely, he's got to heal you. So he's going to keep you indefinitely on the end of tubes and all kinds of things. While there's a certain grave demeanor to all this, and all the nurses are so pleasant and so totally distant because they know this is death. And they may be frank with you. That's why they feel distant. It's not that they're not concerned. It's not that they're heartless people, but that they just don't know how to be frank, like lots of people when they meet a drunk. They don't know what to do with a drunk because he's not behaving right. So when you're dying, you're not behaving right. You're supposed to live. See, so we don't know what to do with a dying person. We don't get around that person and say, listen, I've got the news for you. You're going to die. And this is going to be great. Look, no more responsibilities. Don't have to pay those bills anymore. Don't have to worry about anything. You're going to just die. And let's go out with a bang. Let's have a party, see? We'll put some of that morphine in you so that you won't hurt too much. But we're going to prop you up in bed, and we're going to bring all our friends around, and we're going to have champagne. And you're going to die at the end of it, see? And it's going to be just marvelous. Just like being born, see? When we had birth problems, see, all women used to think that birth had to be painful. It was good for them. It was one of the things you had to suffer because you'd been screwing around with people, and therefore you had to have a child, and it's going to hurt. And then the doctors got together and they scratched their heads, and the man called Grantly Dick Reed said, no, birth doesn't hurt, it's natural. All we've got to do is to talk these women into the idea that it doesn't hurt, that all these so-called pains are just tensions, and that birth is great. It's not a disease. It's not really something you ought to go to hospital for, because you associate hospitals with diseases and sickness. Birth isn't sickness. All right, now let's do some new thinking. What about death? Is death sickness? Or is it a healthy, natural event like being born? Of course it is. So, I mean, a little change in social attitude about this will fortify everybody else. I mean, if I'm alone and all my relatives are kind of pretending to me, it's going to be hard for me. I've got to challenge the whole bunch of them and get my dander up and say, listen, damn you, I don't want all this thing around here. You've got to take a different attitude about my death. Well, that's hard. But if everybody helps me, and we do, we're all one body, if they all come around and say, congratulations, you're going to die. Liberation. Liberation now, you see. Because just before you die, I mean, look, I know very well a skillful priest handling a person dying can do this for them. But he has to talk very, very, very straight. And he has to say, listen, these doctors, don't you pay any attention to them. They're trying to amuse you and deceive you. You're going to die. This isn't terrible. But it's just going to be the end of you as a system of memories. And so you've got a great chance right now, before it happens, to let go of everything. Because you know it's going to go, and it is going to help you. It's going to help you let go of everything. So if you have any possessions left, give them away. Give everything away. And if you have anything to say that is you felt that you ought to say before you die and that you're kind of hanging on to and it's bothering you, say it. I mean, I don't mean necessarily a last confession, but say it said that Adlai Stevenson, shortly before he died, said that he had been making a monkey of himself because he didn't agree with the government's policy about something or other. You know, he had to get that off his chest because he had a little thought in the back of his mind that things were catching up with him, you see? So the moment comes when this thing called death has to be taken completely, not as some ghastly accident, something that all your friends are going to stay away because you're awful. I mean, sometimes people, when they die, are in a very unpleasant physical condition. They don't smell good, they don't look good, and so on. But an enormous amount can be done with scientific methods to make things reasonably tidy from a purely sensory point of view. But the main thing is the attitude, that death is as positive as birth and should be a matter for rejoicing, because death is the symbol of the liberation. There is a wonderful saying that Ananda Kumara Swami used to quote, I pray that death will not come and find me still unannihilate. In other words, that man dies happy if there is no one to die. In other words, if the ego has disappeared before death caught up with it. But you see, the knowledge of death helps the ego to disappear, because it tells you you can't hang on. So what we need, if we're going to have a good religion around, that's one of the places where it can start. Having, I don't know, well, nowadays I suppose they'd call it the Institution for Creative Dying. But something like that. And you can have one department where you can have champagne cocktail party to die with, another department where you can have glorious religious rituals and priests and things like that, another department where you can have psychedelic drugs, another department where you can have special kinds of music, anything, you know. All these arrangements will be provided for in a hospital for delightful dying. But that's the thing, to go out with a bang instead of a whimper.
He died from something related.
Oh. Suicidal. So that was Alan Watts. And he's one of those old lecturers from way back, and profound thinkers and forward thinker, and you know, you have big auditoriums full of people that he would talk to. And Susan was just telling me that he went out with a bang himself.
I don't remember, I read it somewhere that he had something really remarkable to say about the fact that he basically killed himself with alcohol, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. Even his all his buddies said, you know, what a brilliant mind, what are you doing? And I can't remember the refrain he had, but it was something, unfortunately, I can't remember, but it was something very positive about doing that, that it isn't necessary, wasn't necessarily a terrible thing.
No, he's assisting himself.
Yeah, assisted suicide.
Assisting himself, yeah.
And I think, you know, you get to maybe a stage of brilliance where, I mean, we all try to quiet our mind. That's the thing I'm doing right now, seriously.
I watched a video with Huxley's wife recently.
Oh, yeah.
And she was talking about he took LSD and had the last final trip on his deathbed. And she said he never had labored breathing or anything. Mm. And she said it's like a little wave that he kind of rode. And then he just very, very peacefully passed. Which I thought, wow.
Right.
LSD, that's going out with a bang.
Well, that's a new something coming up in the world now.
Yeah.
They're using it for people who are dying because then you don't have to go through all that anguish and suffering.
Right.
Maybe.
Or maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's so like childbirth. You never, each person has their own particular labor and then rebirth or whatever.
Yeah. Well, see, maybe it's interesting because you receive the softening at some point. And hopefully you got it before you died so you could ride it gracefully like the wave that it is.
It's true.
I have, so we were talking the other day about this girl, Andrea Gibson. We saw a little clip with Anderson Cooper and her girlfriend talking about the late Andrea Gibson. And it was super sweet. We're going to try to cue that soundbite up for us next, later. But right now I have a clip of Andrea Gibson talking about morality. So let's hear
mortality.
Or mortality, sorry. Morality.
The morality of mortality.
The mortal moral. All right, here we go.
The funniest thing through this time is that folks will interact with me as if I'm going through something that they're not going through. And so I've shared so much about this experience, not because I want people to know that I am mortal, but because I really want people to know that they are. I'm Andrea Gibson. I'm a spoken word artist or spoken word poet.
I have to cancel my fall tour.
2.5 years ago, I got diagnosed with ovarian cancer. The doctors declared it incurable.
To love yourself.
And I've been writing about my experience with cancer ever since and sharing it pretty consistently online.
Rare, love squirrels. Ah, that one's cute. God, they have such attitude.
I feel so healthy. It's wild. It's wild. I mean, I feel physically very healthy, but I feel far more healthy mentally than I ever have in my life.
The pharmacist said Klonopin, Lamictal, lithium, Xanax. The doctor said an antipsychotic might help me forget what the trauma said. The trauma said, don't write this poem. Nobody wants to hear you cry about the grief inside your bones.
Prior to cancer, I was extremely depressed. I was drinking regularly. I struggled with suicidality, not because of depression, but because the amount of fear that I lived with. And so I would say since the moment of my diagnosis, since I woke up from surgery and my partner told me the news, I could suddenly see the ways that I had spent my life battling the facts of my life. And I was no longer in that place. I actually had a lot of compassion and sympathy for people on a spiritual path because I could see the trying connected with that path and the desperation to arrive to a new place. And that is a wall between getting there. It was just about, and this is something that everybody can do, is you're just consistently letting down your guard. It's not about retrieving anything. It's not about adding anything. It is literally about letting go. Hi, wonderfuls. I have to share some news that I really don't want to share. As many of you know, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer exactly a year ago, and I recently found out that I'm having a recurrence. I did a surgery when the cancer returned, and it sort of returned everywhere. When I got home from that surgery, the pain that I was experiencing was unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. And I could feel that the pain was worsening and worsening because I was in so much resistance to it. The hardest thing that I think I ever did was the second where I said, okay, I allow this. I will allow this pain. I could cry about it now because it was such a transformative moment for me. And I said, I allow this. I will not fight against what is, because this pain is my life right now. I'm not going to fight against my life. And then afterwards, I thought, well, I can do anything. I mean, what else can I say yes to and feel my whole being like bloom? When people ask me now if I'm out of the woods, I say, I'll never be out of the woods. There's something so beautiful about the woods. You tap into the brevity of something and all of a sudden everything becomes more special. That's why for a lot of this time, I've not necessarily felt that I have less time than anybody else, because I'm walking through this world where I'm watching everybody walk by the moment, and there is no moment but this one. And I know this stuff has been said so often, but I didn't know how ecstatic the moment is, how full it is, and how expansive it is. There is so much more time in a moment than there is in a decade, which is still something I'm trying to find language for. I think that the artist's primary job is to tell the truth, but I think that there is an additional job, which is to create hope, to inspire awe. I think the poet's job is to remind us that we were born astonished. I have since learned that we are never, ever supposed to grow out of that. It is how this world is supposed to look. And you start to see it just as soon as you decide to see it.
Wow. Say that again.
I said she's remarkable.
Isn't she?
Yeah. That's what the moment, what did she say about the moment?
And she says there's more time in a moment than there is in a decade.
That's something to remember.
Yeah.
Wow. And then what is the thing that we wanted to play on the radio show, but it wasn't out yet?
The assumed death of Andrea Gibson. So let's see if I can just play it out over my
Talk about another
phone.
New concept.
Here we go. We'll try this. This is pretty interesting.
I saw something you wrote where you say you started to use the word allegedly when you talk about Andrea's death, which I kind of love.
It felt so weird to talk with such certainty and to say Andrea died, as if any of us even know what that means. We actually don't know what it means.
It's true.
I don't think.
No, it's true.
I had felt so many sort of signs and communications that it just didn't feel right, and it still doesn't to say Andrea died. So I love saying that Andrea allegedly died. To my limited understanding of a body and a spirit, language is very important to me, so if I feel like something is not quite getting it right, I'm going to make whatever adjustments I need.
I think that idea...
I invite you to try it, Anderson.
Well, no, I'm crying because what you said is so unique and I think true. And yeah, we have no idea what this means.
Allegedly,
Andrea allegedly died. They were so sweet. They were so in love, and there were two poets,
and the way she said, like, language is important, words are important, and you know, we say died like we know what it means. and to kind of further refine our language and how we use words and to get closer to.
Well, I also liked the fact that, you know, there are things that we just don't have language for.
Or we have words that we've overused for.
Yeah.
So we need to kind of refine, mm-hmm. like death,
mm-hmm.
allegedly died. There's a lot of words out there that make me crazy because they have no meaning anymore. They're used so much.
Yeah. I do like that she allegedly died.
Yeah.
It definitely makes your mind wander to a different place. Somebody contacted her for an interview, and she talks about it in this little clip. And it just also shows sort of her attitude through her diagnosis and through her journey. And so I wanted to play this little short one minute clip. Andrea Gibson.
I am not a good dancer. I am a great dancer in that I love to dance, especially because my dancing always makes my partner laugh, and her laughter is my favorite song. I could choreograph my life to that sound. 2 years ago, when I was diagnosed with cancer, I didn't stop dancing. I started dancing even more. Hips moving like a tiny gay Elvis, making a Graceland of whatever so-called graceless place I was in, the radiologist's waiting room, the elevator on my way to surgery, my kitchen, the night a scan revealed the cancer was back. Again, I danced to keep my head up. And I'm yet to meet anyone who can thrust their pelvis while simultaneously windmilling their arms as efficiently as I can. So efficiently, glaciers stop melting when they catch wind of the planet-saving moves my limbs are up to. A while back, I was contacted by a podcast called The Meditative Story. I figured they wanted to talk about cancer, but when we got on the phone, they said, you know, we're mostly interested in talking about your dancing. And basketball, and maybe a little bit about cancer. If you'd like to give it a listen, details below. Either way, I hope my dance moves made your day.
I just love her attitude.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. She reminds me of my friend who likes to dance too.
And to go into facing death in such a positive way. I mean, that's kind of, if our show has any purpose, it's to highlight that whole other side of death.
Yeah.
Beside the one that the old 20th century one. So people like her are inspiring.
Yeah. She's really left a lot of stuff behind. She's got a film called The Good Light that is on Apple TV. And I think you can watch it on YouTube too. But I haven't seen it yet because I know what I'm going to watch because I know her story, you know, mm-hmm. and I've been sort of following these two women for a little while, so I have to hunker down to watch that one.
Yeah, I'm impressed that you even heard of her.
But
I never heard of her.
Yeah, I was surprised she was on Anderson Cooper. I was actually really glad Anderson's tapped into the death and grief community. Good job, Anderson.
Well, he's had a lot of it.
Yeah.
So
his mom and his brother and his sister.
Yeah.
Plus everybody in Hollywood that he works with or what have you.
And he went out into the war fields.
Yeah.
And watched.
In Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he, like you, Jenna, he's really doing the work.
Oh, man.
Right there in the fields.
Here's another one from the field. We've got Robin Williams on the fragile meaning of life and that we see it too late. So this is interesting to see what it is that his perspective was on all of this. Here we go.
There's a line in Garp that you say you can look at the arc of your life and find it interesting. That's what's been for me. It's nice that it has been getting better and better. That's the only thing I pull out of it. I mean, that's nice. That it keeps trying, and the fact that I'm offered these amazing things to keep doing stuff that keeps exploring different aspects, that's wonderful too.
The first movie was Popeye.
Yeah.
And if you remember, the opening scene is Robin in a rowboat in a storm, and I was just here was this huge screen at Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, and I thought, that's Robin, my little boy Robin. Look at him. Eat your heart out, world. Here he comes.
Performing and doing all these things, we never acknowledge anything negative. Where it's, and if you do, it gets very violent, like the time, mm-hmm. what happens immediately after the scene you just saw is, he starts to confront who you are. So mm-hmm. you, I know who you are, and he would have really hurt Jeff's character if he'd gone any further. And that's why he goes, the hallucination guards against that. It's basically, it is freeing to create that character, because you can really explore kind of where you've been and the aspects of why you would want to deny, and that kind of whole mm-hmm. aspect of, you know, performing for the sake of just avoiding. For him, love is such a delicate thing that if, and even getting it back again triggers another one of the breakdowns. Uh-huh. It's so fragile for him, and that's what makes it interesting. That's why I did it.
There's a sadness, and then you have to go, and there's also hope. I mean, a sadness, it's always like, yeah, you wish they hadn't happened, but they did. And the purpose is to make you different. It's what they call a Buddhist gift. I would call it the ultimate Christian gift. It's that idea of, you're back and you realize the thing that matters are others, way beyond yourself. Self goes away. Ego, bye-bye.
You're not easy on yourself in this show, are you?
No. You know, as an alcoholic, I talk about, you know, some warning signs, you know, like DUIs in a cul-de-sac, things like that. The idea of, you know, have you been through it to talk about it and see, like, you know, this is what you go through, heart surgery, you know, alcoholism. I went to rehab in wine country just to keep my options open. You know, these are things you got to talk about.
You want to talk about it?
No.
Why is there such a heavy, heavy-duty problem with drugs? That addresses the psychology of a nation. That's why I talk about it. You try and tell people you do it. Just say no. No, just say Noriega. No, beyond that. It is something much, much deeper. And yes, you're right. There is something wrong. But people are slowly waking up. The time is over for just sitting going, it'll be taken care of. And I try to address it in, using the only weapon I have, comedy. And that's all we do. And I hope people wake up, and they are. We ask for your help, and we'll try and help from this end, and we'll meet, and there will be a kinder, gentler nation one day. Thank you.
And we all have a great need for acceptance. But you must trust that your beliefs are unique, your own, even though others may think them odd or unpopular, even though the herd may go, that's bad.
I don't envision myself as a teacher or as I can't proselytize to people even when we talk about drugs or anything. I'm a player. And mm-hmm. in the sense of just in the process of playing, you can talk about some interesting things, mm-hmm. you know, that there's things that, you know, why we've evolved to, you know, to make that connection, to go on, to do amazing things. And that moment, talked about this once, that there is a thing when you create, when you find that little tiny flash, when you find some
it's like
idea.
It's bliss.
Well, because the brain gives you the same reinforcement that it does with sex.
I mean, that's right.
And the reason the brain gives you a little hit of endorphin when you create is just to keep you going.
Here's a taste.
Yes.
Keep creating, you get another taste.
Because mm-hmm. you're only given a little spark of madness. And if you lose that, you're nothing.
Basically, when you're really firing and it really works, it's like musicians have said it, or writers say it, it's just, you're just channeling. It's truly that's why you say that divine inspiration, where it just passes, you're just letting it through you.
I just wanted to ask Robin real quick about what's his favorite type of movie in terms of ones that make social impacts or ones that are fun, loving, like Aladdin, for example.
They both, I mean, I love doing both of them because I think in their own way, they both have some effect. I remember people coming up after Aladdin and saying, you know, it was such a great thing that they could sit with their kid and laugh mm-hmm. as much as their child. That, I think, is a great thing. It's like, you know, Sullivan's Travels, where you see people just having a wonderful time, especially in times like this. Mm-hmm. Why you do a movie is to learn, to expand yourself, to push yourself. It was like Peter Weir when I did Dead Poets Society. He said the power of silence, that he said, you don't have to do anything and make a point. And or the power of thought. But, you know, you learn something and you make a movie, which is a double bill.
Yeah.
And you get paid. If the truth is, if they knew it, I'd probably do it for much less.
I don't know how much value I have in this universe, but I do know that I made a few people happier than they would have been without me. And as long as I know that, I'm as rich as I ever need to be.
I mean, you know, some movies you do for money, and those are the dangerous ones. Mm. Old dogs, we'll talk later. The idea that you do those and you go, and you know why you're making them. It's a kid's comedy, you know it's going to be silly, and you know that's going to be up for grabs. But with something like World's Greatest Dad, it's like, No, you do it as a labor of love, and you do it with friends who you feel like you can do it with and say, hey, we're both in this together, and that's kind of wonderful. They're all done with this kind of love, you know, you commit to it and you go, whatever happens, I'm in, I'm proud of it, you know. That's always what I want to do, is to try different things and kind of always change perceptions.
And change the rhythm. You can...
Yeah, break up, it is a rhythm. It's basically saying, okay, now we hit it, you know, that, and then, you know, hit a little harder and then back off and then go berserk, like, you know, with the stand-up, which is just free form, and then come back and play something so controlled, like in 1 hour photo. Those are all possible, and having that range really helps. For me, it's great, and but having great friends and family that just make life extraordinary, and a world to still go out and see and learn about, which is the most important of all. Just look at your own life and just realize what things are precious to you. That's what I did when I was doing it. You know, I would come home and just realize how extraordinary that there is. You have heaven in front of you. That idea that you have, look around and see the precious things, the connection with family, friends, you know, the things in your, and the people, especially in your life.
My kids are extraordinary. Did they go through rough times? Yeah, but you come out the other side, I go, God, they're so amazing. I'm so blessed.
I would hope that there would be, if there's an afterlife, that would have the places that I, or at least a version of the places I've grown that I think are extraordinary here. Mountains, lakes, forests, beaches with perfect curl. But also, I mean,